KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fogring, and we have kind of a combo plate this morning. I'd like to start off with saying a little bit about the Rohingya in Burma, or Myanmar, as it is often called. It's been in the news a lot lately, sort of been pushed aside by more recent developments, but the Rohingya are people from, they are Muslims, and they live in in the Rakhine state of Myanmar, and they've been in kind of battle with the Burmese government now for quite a while, longer than just recently. And the Burmese claim that they are actually they are Bengalis who kind of been migrating into the Rakhine state. And recently, what happened was that there is some kind of a Rohingya militia or Islamic group that attacked some Burmese government soldiers, and the Burmese struck back very ferociously, and it's been called ethnic cleansing, which may be true, maybe not, I don't know. But one interesting thing about the situation, you know, is that, and this is a... An Irish journalist named Geroid O'Coleman, he claims that there really is no such ethnic group, that Rohingya is the sort of a Bengali-derived word for Arakan. And Arakan was a principality or a little kingdom that existed before Burma came on the scene. And it's located where our Rakhine state is now. And so O'Coleman claims that these people are Bengalis. And back in the late 1800s, when the British Empire ruled India, which included what is now Bangladesh, also ruled Burma, that the Brits brought in these people as farm labor, and also to help administer the state there. And he compares this to when the Brits brought in Irish Protestant settlers, brought to Ireland, Northern Ireland's Protestant settlers from Scotland. A very similar situation. And that Northern Irish, the Ulster people, this is O'Coleman writing, that the Rohingya got a favored treatment from the British Empire, and that they also helped repress the native population, and that they are now the majority in Rakhine State. This is... what Irish journalist Geroid O'Coleman says, and I've been sort of trying to check that out. It's very interesting that there's a book written by a professor and published by the University of Cornell Press, and it's called Weapons of Mass Migration. It's by a woman named Kelly Greenhill, and it's a genuine academic book, and it deals with how migration is used as a weapon, as a kind of a political or geopolitical move by various world actors. And that O'Coleman compares this to the situation of the Bosnian Muslims and the Rwandan Tutsis. Let's take those one at a time. The Bosnian Muslims are really no different ethnically from the Slavic people of Bosnia and the region. In fact, they are their main difference is that during the time of the Ottoman Empire, they converted to Islam, and that they also received favored treatment from the Ottoman Empire, which did not endear them to the their fellow in the region. And in Rwanda, the Tutsis were a tribe that migrated down from the north, and they a similar situation happened there, that under the Belgian colonial empire, the Tutsis were sort of the gendarmes, and that after independence, the Hutu tribes who had been repressed by them kind of rose up against them, which is at the root cause of the genocides you've seen in Rwanda, which actually happened on both sides. So this is an interesting thing about the Rohingya. What is behind the turmoil and the violence going on there now is that the Rohingya have a past, a history, and they have been in sort of antagonized the native population, and apparently they are now the majority in that state. So that is sort of the case that that Myanmar would present against in their favor. One thing about Myanmar, it has a whole lot of different ethnic populations, and some of them are in rebellion against the central government. So it's a lot of turmoil going on in that nation. And sort of going back to the idea of weapons of mass migration, there seems to be some indication that various outside interests are using or preparing to use this situation as a way against China, because China, which is now embarked on its One Belt, One Road endeavor, has got all sorts of business agreements with Myanmar, and turmoil in that country would kind of upset these arrangements, and could lead to some kind of geopolitical moves against China itself. So this is something I'm still checking out. I haven't formed any definite conclusions, but I would recommend that people, if you're interested, read up on this situation. It is very interesting, and it's one interesting thing is how it does compare to other situations, like in Bosnia and Rwanda, where different favored tribes were used by imperial or corporate interests. Now let's move on to Catalonia, which had a referendum, which was attempted. The Spanish government moved in with brutal force and tried to smash this referendum without much success. but it certainly got in all the got in the news. Pictures of brutality of people being beaten and dragged by their hair and everything else just for trying to vote. I would might remark that if something like this happened in Russia or Cuba, there would be no end to the denunciations. But anyway, Catalonia voted in a referendum, and they voted to secede from the nation of Spain. The next step, I believe, that the leader in Catalonia is going to declare independence sometime very soon. And what happens after that, I really don't know. But let's go back a few centuries. Back in 1137, Catalonia was an independent nation, little nation state in northeastern Spain on the French border, and they were united by marriage with the neighboring kingdom of Aragon, which is immediately to the west. And then a few centuries later, King Ferdinand of Aragon, this is in 1469, King Ferdinand of Aragon married Queen Isabella of Castile. And he kind of dragged his people along into this proto-Spain. This is the beginning of the Spanish unity. Of course, King Ferdinand and Isabella were pretty famous rulers. One thing they did, they expelled the Moors from the area, and they also expelled the Jews. And then they also sent Christopher Columbus on his voyage to the Americas. So that's how, basically, how Catalonia became part of Spain. It was sort of dragged there by its various kings. Catalonia also backed the wrong side in the War of Spanish Succession, which is sort of pitting the royal Bourbons against the royal Habsburgs, and they took the wrong side, and they lost out, and they were repressed under Franco, and of course, recently, they were beaten up under Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy. An interesting thing going on here is that our two principles are sort of colliding. One is a principle of self-determination, that any people have a right to name their own rulers and rule themselves, basically. And that principle is in on a collision course with the principle of we might call sacred borders or territorial integrity, which has been around for quite a while. It was first promulgated with the Treaties of Westphalia back in 1648, which ended the 30 Years' War. And the idea is that nations sort of replace the church as rulers of secular rulers, and the nations sort of that within their borders they have the right to do pretty much as they please. And so you can see how these principles are in opposition. If you have a nation that sort of wants to do what it will within its borders, but some people within that nation are feel aggrieved, or they are repressed, or they are a minority, or whatever, that they might want to secede. And so this has been, it came up in Catalonia, it came up in the Balkans, it came up in Scotland, it came up, it's been up in Northern Ireland, and here in Canada with Quebec voting on secession a couple decades ago. So, but these are both sort of legitimate principles of geopolitics. But my own personal view is that seeing how nations are formed or have been formed throughout history, kind of by war and conquest and royal chicanery, I kind of come down on the self-determination side. And so I had this idea that wouldn't it be neat if they had a worldwide plebiscite, every nation in the world, and people were asked, what nation would they really like to belong to? Are you happy with the borders you live in? If not, what would you like? And just to, if nothing else, it might give an idea of how people in the world feel about where they live. The only trouble with the self-determination is that outsiders often meddle. That certainly happened in the Balkans. The outsiders were all over the Balkans, pushing Bosnian independence and Kosovo independence. And they were also all over the situation in Rwanda, which has its own troubled history. But outsiders will meddle. So it's the Washington Post recently had an article, and the headline was, Catalonia held a referendum. Russia won. So basically, the Washington Post is blaming this whole thing on Russia. And it was based on an article in the Spanish newspaper El País. And it seems to me, I read the article, and it just, to me, it does not hold together. For one thing, Vladimir Putin does not really seem as generally supported the idea of territorial integrity. That was a basis for his intervention or coming to the aid of Syria in its civil war, that he was saying that Syria was being attacked from outside and that Syria had the right to invite other nations to help them, and that's what Russia was doing. Now, you may not agree with that, but that is a principle that Putin was upholding. Russia gets blamed for a lot of things. There's this Russia, so-called Russiagate bandwagon keeps rolling along if we sort of ignore the fact that the wheels keep coming off. Recently, there was an article by Glenn Greenwald about Russia was blamed for, let's see if I can find the article here. They were blamed for attempts to hack into U.S. voting systems. And this is based exclusively on claims by the Department of Homeland Security. Well, Glenn Greenwald, writing in The Intercept, kind of really takes that whole thing apart. I recommend that you read it. And he also lists about half a dozen other things that the Russians were blamed for that totally fell apart on closer examination. One that comes to mind was the Vermont electrical grid. The Russians were accused of threatening the power grid in Vermont, which is completely false. And it turned out that one story that in the New York Times, and this has been mentioned, I believe it was even mentioned on Democracy Now! This morning, that the Russians used Twitter accounts or something to manipulate U.S. politics. And Glenn Greenwald writes that this is based on the claims of a new group that was just formed by a sort of combination of neocons and Democratic Party security officials. And this is Greenwald writing. This group is, quote, led by longtime liars and propagandists such as Bill Kristol, former acting CIA chief Mike Morrell, and Bush Homeland Security Secretary Mike Chertoff. And so this is the basis for some of these accusations against Russia. Well, I recommend that you check them out yourself. These have been going on for quite a long time. They seems to be a never. They don't stop. They just keep rolling along. It's like zombies. And the one ironic thing is that the arch meddler, the U.S., is the one accusing Russia of meddling. And the U.S. has been meddling all over the place, including in Russia and including in Ukraine. And supposedly the Russians are, their purpose is making America look bad. Well, I think there's a reason America looks bad. It's got nothing to do with the Russians, because our system, our political system, put Donald Trump in the White House, and there's no getting around that. Trying to blame Russia seems to me just kind of laughable. And getting back, you know, talking about Ukraine, remember when you had State Department officials in there in Kiev passing out cookies to the rioters in the streets of Kiev, and sort of, can you imagine Sergei Lavrov passing out blini at the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations? It's just, nothing like that has happened. We've also hear a lot about fake news, and there's an interesting article on that which I would like to call the people's attention. This is in the UK Independent by Mary Dajewski, and the headline is, Russia was a target of NATO's own fake news. And it had to do with a Russian a military exercise which recently occurred called Zapad, and is apparently in response to NATO exercises right on the Russian borders in Poland and the Baltic nations. And the West, our leaders, presented Zapad as some kind of a huge rehearsal for invading Poland or invading the Baltic nations. They greatly exaggerated the number of troops, and it all turned out to be fake news. And that was written about by Mary Dajewski, writing in the UK Independent. I recommend that article, too. Well, I'm not sure where this... At the same time, it's very interesting that while this sort of new Cold War between the U.S. and Russia keeps rolling along, there are also indications that maybe it might be ending. I saw a headline in one story that the U.S. and Russia are calling a halt to their quarrels. And there's also an article in the U.K. Guardian that the U.S. and Russia are planning to build a joint moon base. And to do that, I would think they would need to have a little peace and peace between them. It's hard to build a moon base when you are at war on Earth. But anyway, we might turn. Let's turn to Puerto Rico. People who are old enough, like me, might remember that after the Cuban Revolution, the U.S. kept presenting Puerto Rico as a sort of a success story. Unlike poverty-stricken Cuba, Puerto Rico was a kind of a vibrant, well-off economy, and a great example to other people in Latin America. And what happened with Puerto Rico is that corporations flocked into this Commonwealth to exercise their tax breaks. But then they left, and they left behind quite a scene. They left behind almost 40 toxic coal ash dumps. The Puerto Rican electric power grid depends on dirty energy, and they left a whole lot of debts. And what is going on now is that the debt vultures are circling. What they do is they buy up debt for a great discount. In other words, if you owe somebody $1 million and you sort of are unable to pay it, or you declare bankruptcy or something, some debt vulture can maybe buy your debt for say $30,000, and then try and collect the original million. which is a huge profit. Donald Trump, of course, was in Puerto Rico recently. He made some offhand remark about somehow that this debt would have to be taken care of. He didn't really say how or how it would happen. It raised the issue of would the bondholders, I think he mentioned Goldman Sachs, would they be required to take what's called a haircut? In other words, would they have to settle for much less than they are really owed? But so this is kind of up in the air right now. But one thing I would remark on is that, you know, you can almost consider Puerto Rico like an early casualty in the in sort of a failing global economy. They are heavily in debt. They face a prospect of weeks and months without electric power. And in any modern economy, everything depends on electricity, which depends on fuel. You need electricity just to pump gas, to pump water. Without electricity, the economy is really in sad shape. And so, but the electricity depends on fossil fuels, generally, to sustain itself. And the use of fossil fuels is what brought on the hurricanes through global warming. So we're in this kind of a bad situation. We're limited to because of climate chaos. In the future, we're going to be limited to sustainable energy. And this may not be enough to power the electric grids that we are used to. We may actually have to cut back. We may have to prioritize what we use our limited electricity for, whether it's hospitals or video games or one thing or another. Also, the debts have been mounting in America and a lot of other countries in the world. Public debts and private debts, you know, the consumer debts are add up to a whole lot. I mean, plus there's something, it's not quite a debt, but you might call them financial obligations, like pensions are money has not been set aside or borrowed yet to meet pension obligations, but there they are. We have one right here in Oregon with the PERS, which apparently is not going to be able to sustain itself. So you have a lack of growth, plus huge debts, and it's hard to see where this can lead to, except in some kind of repudiation of debts. But I finally like to wind up something on a little happier note. This is a possible solution for the situation in North Korea. The U.S. has been saying for a while now, Donald Trump, that that China should step in, you know, should kind of step up to the plate and help out with this situation. That China is North Korea's main ally and biggest trading partner, and that China has been not willing to put pressure on North Korea. Well, what the U.S. wants is some kind of pressure, but what China may be up to is something else. And it's very interesting. North Korea recently secured a second internet line via Russia, and which connects them to the outside world. And the Chinese, for years now, they've been embarking on this One Belt, One Road project, and it would include a rail link to South Korea. Right now, you can a train can go from China to Portugal in 16 days, which is half the time it would take a ship. And so, China would like to include South Korea in this rail link. Well, to get to South Korea, they have to go through North Korea. So North Korea would be included in the One Belt, One Road project, would be tied into the main power in this new world economy. But this would really not please the United States very much, because the United States has been trying to sort of sabotage the One Belt, One Road project. So there we have it. China is offering a way out, and we will see what the U.S. intends to do about it. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for KBOO, your radio station.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pathway 1000 Community Kickoff on Saturday, October 7th at 10 a.m. at PCC's Workforce Training Center in Portland. Pathway 1000 is a Portland Community Reinvestment Initiatives campaign to mitigate displacement and reclaim the historic heart and soul of Portland's African American community in North and Northeast Portland. The purpose of this initiative is to build prosperity for African Americans and others displaced from Portland's North and Northeast neighborhoods by creating 1,000 affordable homes. Again, that's the Pathway 1000 Community Kickoff, Saturday, October 7th, 10 a.m. at PCC's Workforce Training Center, 5600 Northeast 42nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Artwork Rebels Tattoos for Harvey Relief event, Sunday, October 8th at 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Artwork Rebels in Portland. The Artwork Rebels Tattoos for Harvey Relief